Today at Reader's Corner, Larry Tye, author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero.
This guy who gave us Superman, the original writer, was a kid who every day when he went out on the playground, when he was in grammar school, he would be bullied and teased. He was a little bit too short, a little bit too round, wore glasses that were a little bit too thick. Millions of kids like you and me grew up with this sense of a hero who either complemented or replaced our father. Every era, basically, he gave us the hero that we needed for that era, and he became a Rorschach test of just what America was going through at that time.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. 75 years after he came to life, Superman remains one of America's most beloved and enduring heroes. In his recent book, Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, author Larry Tye examines everything from Superman's roots in Jewish texts to his political views and traces his evolution from the pages of DC comic books to his portrayal on radio and TV and in film. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Tye. His book provides a new perspective on the mythical crusader who was born on the doomed planet Krypton and who grew up to become a champion of all that is good and just here on Earth. I first interviewed Larry Tye on our show in 2010 about his New York Times bestseller, Satchel, the story of pitching great Satchel Paige. A former reporter at the Boston Globe, he now runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists. Mr. Tye joined us by phone for this interview. Larry Tye, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Great to be back with you.
So how did Superman last for all of these years? Some of these guys, these superheroes come and go, but here we are with Superman alive and well 75 years later. And in fact, and I'm sure many people don't know this, Warner Brothers, I learned, is going to release another Superman movie called Man of Steel in 2013. How's this happen?
They are indeed, and I think there are two keys to his survivability. One is the fact that he changed with the times. I say that he evolved more than the fruit fly, that in the 1930s, when what we needed in the middle of the Great Depression and on the eve of World War II, we needed a hero in the FDR New Deal mold, and Superman was a crusading social reformer. He was out taking down slumlords and wife beaters. In the 1940s, we needed somebody to inspire us as we went to war, and he did that. He stayed on the home front. The government used him as a symbol to do everything from sell war bonds to basically get inspired about why we were fighting for. We were fighting for this thing that became known in the Superman myth of the 1940s as the American way. In the 50s, America's biggest concern was the Red Menace, and so was Superman. Every era, basically, he gave us the hero that we needed for that era, and he became a Rorschach test of just what America was going through at that time. But if his ability to change was one key, then his ability to maintain this steadfastness to what he really stood for, which was truth and justice in the American way, this clunky familiarity and Dudley Do-Right nature of his character was, I think, the other key to why we keep going back to him. He is reassuring in that he never hesitates in distinguishing right from wrong. It comes like a second nature to him.
You know, you mentioned the 1940s, and I thought I knew Superman pretty well as a kid growing up. Again, I have to admit, I didn't remember the 40s radio shows of Superman. I think there's not much I'm too young for anymore, Larry, but I just might have missed a little bit of that because I was a little too small for that at the time. But the fact is that what shocked me was the way you brought out this issue of Superman on radio in the 40s taking on the Ku Klux Klan. And I'm thinking, you know, in the 40s, That's a fairly ambitious and dangerous thing to do on national radio. Would you explain how that came about?
Sure. It came about the same way everything did with Superman back in those days when there were very few people involved with the character. The politics of whoever was handling him in that medium often became the politics of Superman. And there was a guy named Robert Maxwell who understood just how powerful this most popular of kids' radio shows was back then. There weren't a whole lot of radio shows. There weren't a whole lot that appealed to kids, and there weren't a whole lot that could take on something as insidious as the Ku Klux Klan. So Maxwell, as a way of lighting a fire under America to go after the Klan, he decided to go after him himself. And he had Superman doing everything from revealing passwords to generally being out there talking about tolerance and talking about the evil Klan and the Grand Dragon. And it was something that supposedly really irked the Grand Dragon of the Klan, that America's number one hero was out there saying just how bad they were and essentially making fun of them. And the best way, I think, to take on an enemy like that is to belittle them. And that is the perfect thing that Superman did for the kids of America.
As I remember reading your book, Superman also got mixed up in America's nuclear programming. And at one point, the U.S. government had to step in and suggest he back off of some of the things that were going on in the comic strip?
That's true. They were about to publish a comic strip that talked about things like a cyclotron, and that talked about things that, on the one hand, there was no way that any of these comic book writers were really going to imperil the American nuclear program that was being developed then. On the other hand, the government didn't want to take any chances, and they didn't want to make this idea of nuclear power and its potential something that was discussed in a part of popular culture. So they stepped in and said, don't do it. And the DC Comics people who were publishing Superman stories didn't do it.
Well, just from these last two examples, you've written a great cultural history of America in this era through the eyes, if you will, of Superman and all of his creators. And I'd like to go back to the beginning because it's also, to some extent, a few biographies of some very important people that made this all happen. And it really was Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster out of Cleveland that put this character together. Help us understand who they were, how they came to create this Superman character we know and love today.
We know a lot about this now because in the process of writing the book, I stumbled upon Jerry Siegel's 100-page unpublished memoir. And what we see there, this guy who gave us Superman, the original writer, was a kid who every day when he went out on the playground, when he was in grammar school, he would be bullied and teased. He was a little bit too short, a little bit too round, wore glasses that were a little bit too thick. And what he would have loved to have done, particularly when the girls were watching, is basically flown away to escape his tormentors. He couldn't do it in real life, so every night when he went to bed, he took a pencil and paper with him, and he had a character that he came up with called the Super-Man, who was a bad guy, who was a guy who, like any kid who's being tormented, could go back and get revenge against his tormentors. And Jerry's original notion of what his hero ought to do is somebody who could basically give him money and power and let him essentially take over the world. That was a child's view of Superman. At age 17, Jerry had something traumatic happen to him that shook him out of his childish ideas. His dad ran a used clothing store in a seedy part of Cleveland, Ohio, and one day three guys walked in and decided to try on a suit and walk out without paying for it. Michael Siegel tried to follow them out. He had a massive heart attack. He essentially dropped dead. And Jerry was suddenly bereft. This youngest of six kids of Jewish-Lithuanian refugees suddenly needed not just a father but a hero. And so one night when he went to bed with his pencil and paper after that, his hero basically was transformed. He dropped the in front of Superman, he dropped the hyphen, and he dropped the bad guy act. And suddenly we had a hero that in the first story that he wrote and in the first drawing of it that his pal Joe Shuster did was a guy who was sweeping in to rescue a man who looked a lot like Michael Siegel that was being robbed. It was the story of Superman was essentially of a boy needing a hero, and it happened to come in a moment when America needed the same kind of hero, a hero who could give them inspiration at a very difficult moment during a depression and on the eve of a war, and it was a perfect marriage of this little boy's conception and of the country's need.
So how did Shuster and Siegel get Superman published?
Well, they spent 5 years trying to do it. They essentially wrote to every one of the comic book and comic strip publishers of that era and they got a stack of rejections. And finally, in 1938, two guys named Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz, two ex-pornographers who were starting their own comic book business, basically came along and said, "We're looking for good stories." Somebody remembered having been sent a story about this character called Superman, and these guys decided to give it a shot. They put Superman on the cover of their first issue of a comic book called Action Comics, and then they put it on every few covers after that for the first dozen issues, and they noticed that every time Superman was on the cover, hundreds of thousands of copies were sold, and it basically sold out, and they understood they had a magic hero here.
You're listening to Larry Tye. He's the author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. I'd like you to comment on two things. First of all, to expand on this issue of Jerry losing his father. I don't think he was the only guy who had a role in creating and maintaining or sustaining Superman that had loss in the family. And secondly, at one point you said Superman was Jewish, because these guys were all Jewish kids, and some of apparently what you see coming out of the original Superman may be related to their religious training or something?
That's true. So let's start out with the issue of Superman and his being a reflection of what kids who didn't have a father needed. It wasn't just Jerry. It was Jack Liebowitz, one of his publishers. It was Bob Maxwell, the guy who did his radio and his early TV shows and the guy who created the campaign against the Ku Klux Klan. It was essentially a lot of kids who either needed a father because their father was missing or dead, or who needed a father because their father just wasn't giving them the sense of what a hero ought to look like. And so millions of kids like you and me grew up with this sense of a hero who either complemented or replaced our father. The notion of what his religion was, essentially over the years, every religion has wanted to embrace Superman. There have been entire books written on how Superman is a Christian figure. He's the Christ story. He is God sending his only son down to earth to show mankind that it can be better than it thought it could be. To Buddhists, Superman is the ultimate Zen character. To atheists and agnostics, they say, why do we need religion? Superman is the perfect secular messiah. But I think the most convincing embrace of Superman is that these two Jewish kids, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who grew up in a neighborhood called Glenville of Cleveland, Ohio, that was 95% Jewish, they were essentially writing about and drawing what they knew and what they knew as a Jewish world. So they gave us a hero whose name on Krypton was Kal-El, which in Hebrew means the voice or the vessel of God. They gave us a hero whose parents saved him by floating him out in space, only to be adopted by two Midwestern Gentiles named Martha and John Kent. And they raised Superman to this boy, Clark Kent, and realized that he had powers that were quite extraordinary. And if that's not the story of Moses and Exodus, I don't know what is. But to me, the most compelling evidence is that any name that ends in the word M-A-N is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, both.
Very interesting. I certainly never thought of any of that. Now, Joe Shuster, the illustrator for Jerry, his boyhood chum, he starts drawing these things. Was he the model for Clark Kent?
Well, Joe Shuster basically said that anytime he wanted to know what Clark Kent should look like, he would just look in the mirror. And Jerry Siegel thought that Clark Kent was modeled on him in terms of what he wanted to be, which is a reporter, and in terms of what he looked like. And I think the truth is that every kid who looks at themselves in the mirror, they on the one hand are faced with this image of a Clark Kent sort of schlumpy looking character, but what they really see when they look at it, they say, geez, if only people could really see inside me and see the true me, they would see that I am really Superman. And that's what Jerry and Joe saw in themselves, and that was why I think they tapped into this vein that made it relevant to every kid who ever read a Superman story.
So where'd Lois Lane come from?
Well, Jerry, as he told the story at times, Lois came from a young model that he and Joe hired and wanted to know what Lois Lane ought to look like and maybe even what she ought to be like. And that model ended up 25 years later becoming Jerry's wife, and that was a woman named Joanne Carter. Now, I think he told the story that way because Joanne was his wife and he wanted to make her look good.
The truth is, Jerry, on his 50th anniversary of Superman, told the story to Time magazine that I think is the real story. And there was a young woman who was in his grammar school and high school classes named Lois Amster. She was the prettiest girl in the class, and she was the girl that Jerry had the eye for, but that didn't know that Jerry existed. And Jerry, I think, modeled Lois Lane on this girl that he would love to have had pay attention to him. And I went back and interviewed Lois Amster. She is now 96 years old. She's moved from Cleveland to Massachusetts, and she's living in a nursing home now. And I think that she was a true model for Lois Lane, and she was worthy of being the model.
So did she keep up with Jerry? Did she remember who he was in class, and did she know he became somewhat famous as the creator of Superman?
She said she barely knew who he was, that he was this awkward kid in her classes, and she had never paid more than a minute's attention to him. But she loved the idea that he had paid attention to her enough to make her the model for, not just for this reporter character, but for a reporter who would become a role model for girls who went into journalism or anything else. She was one of the really few strong female role models. She never let anybody, including Clark Kent, push her around. And she was a tough broad, and Lois Amster loved having her modeled.
That's great. Well, how many times have we heard of these creators who put something together do not really understand the future value of what they put together and then sell it for nothing? And you seem to be telling this story over again. In the case of Jerry and Joe, they sold the comic strip to DC Comics, what was it, like $130?
Exactly, to be split between the two of them for the rights not just to that first 13-page story, but for the rights to Superman in any medium forever.
And they didn't get it copyrighted themselves. What do you think that cost them over their lifetimes?
Well, I think it cost them hundreds of millions of dollars over their lifetime, and they think it cost them that, which is why they perpetually sued DC Comics and perpetually lost. And the irony in the whole thing is, so the original sin of comics is Jerry and Joe are hired, create this character, are so desperate to publish it, they'll sell it for anything. The good news for Jerry and Joe was that they got paid quite handsome salaries and that they became famous themselves. Their character became an iconic figure. The bad news was they didn't share in the royalties. Today, a lawsuit by Jerry and Joe's heirs is pending in California. The heirs have won the first stage of the lawsuit, and it looks like Superman, at least parts of the right to Superman, may revert back to the heirs of Jerry and Joe. The sad thing is that Jerry and Joe are dead, that Jerry's wife died within the last year, and that all their close heirs are really old and not especially healthy.
What would be, I mean, this isn't a legal show, and maybe you don't even know, but I'm just curious, since they didn't protect the copyright, what would be their legal claim to any of this if they gave it all away at that time?
Their legal claim is partly the copyright law has changed, and so therefore more favorable to them. And it's partly like the creation that they came up with. What the judge has said so far is that some of the things they came up with were things that they took to DC Comics before they ever worked for them, and that really ought to have been their independent product. The things that they wrote into the character, like the ability to fly, which didn't come for years later, like the X-ray vision, like lots of things like that, they were clearly employees of DC Comics, and DC owns that. But I think what we need to resolve this stuff is we need somebody with the wisdom of Solomon, because if parts of Superman go to the creators and their heirs, and parts of it go to DC Comics, we'll have a character that's been split in half, and like the baby that Solomon was about to tear in half, the baby will be destroyed. We need somebody who can keep it all together. There's plenty of money to go around for all the heirs and the owners and even all the lawyers.
You're listening to Larry Tye. He's the author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. So tell us about the Superman curse. And before you do that, I might point out that it is pretty unusual to have two of the actors having almost the same last names. I mean, here you have George Reeves, and later on you have Christopher Reeve. That's really weird that you've got these two guys with almost the same last names being the two most prominent people that have ever played Superman. But back to the curse.
back to the curse, so that George and Chris shared something other than a last name that was spelled almost identically. They shared the idea that maybe something was cursed about being affiliated with this character, that George Reeve, this great guy who brought Superman to the TV screen when I was a kid and when you were a kid and became our model for what Superman ought to look and act like, ended up taking out one night from his bedside table a German Luger and putting it to his head and killing himself. And if you were like me, a 10-year-old kid in 1959 when this happened, the idea that Superman could kill himself was not only improbable, it was physically impossible. How could Superman? He was bulletproof. He couldn't shoot himself. But kids across America were shocked to find out that Superman was dead. Fast forward 20 years, and Christopher Reeve, who brings Superman to the big screen so successfully that he stars in 4 Superman movies, he has an accident while he's out riding a horse years later, and he nearly severs his neck. And he ends up being in a wheelchair, doing courageous things in terms of raising money for stem cell research and people with spinal cord injuries, but basically ending up becoming a character who never could walk again or who had trouble doing anything and ended up dying of an infection that he got from being in a wheelchair. And so you had this curse that not only affected the two of them, but lots of people associated with Superman over the years had bad things happen to them. On the other hand, lots of people were associated with Superman over the years, and people have bad things happen to them. And whether or not it was beyond the pale, it was unusual in terms of how high-profile those things were.
Yeah, those are really tragedies, and I do remember the Christopher Reeve movie and thought a great deal of it. But frankly, my real Superman, and you just mentioned it, growing up in the 50s, I can remember rushing home from school, and if I'm not mistaken, it was on sometime after school, before the evening news or whatever, and man, you'd sit around and just wait for every one of those episodes, and Perry White, the editor, and Lois Lane, and Jerry, wasn't it Jerry?
It was Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen, yeah. I mean, those characters just to this day are just lifelike to me. And I'd like to talk a little bit about George Reeves, because this is a guy, and I didn't even focus on it or remember much about it until I read your book. At age 45, he dies, and the circumstance surrounding that really sound fishy to me. Tell us what you think happened.
So what I think, first of all, I can never talk too much about George Reeves because he was my original Superman. Like you,
yeah.
I think everybody fell in love with the first Superman they encountered. And when I close my eyes today and think of Superman, it is George Reeves I see. And he was not a great actor. When you go back and look at those shows, he didn't change his voice. He barely changed his appearance going from Superman to Clark Kent. And yet we wanted to believe. We believed enough that we didn't question the fact that when the gangsters shot at him, the bullets bounced off. But no kid ever asked why, after bullets bounced off him, did he duck when they threw the gun at him. But what mattered was he was our believable Superman. He was a strong and powerful and looked like a morally righteous guy. And yet a combination of taking painkillers for a couple car accidents that he had, drinking too much, and being a bit despondent about the fact that he was stereotyped as Superman, that triple combination came along and killed him. There's been lots of speculation over the years whether he might have been murdered, and I spent lots of time with the county coroner out in L.A. and with lots of modern-day forensic experts looking over all the evidence, and the sad truth is it was suicide by a guy who should never have died that young.
You know, I can still remember thinking back to those TV shows where if there were two villains, he'd grab them by the scruff of their necks. He'd grab them by the clothing they had on, and he'd hold them up and then throw them toward the law, the peace officers or whoever was there to take them into custody. But it was never the kind of brutal and violent behavior that you see today.
That's precisely what he did, and he actually grabbed... Before America got involved with World War II, Superman went off to Germany and to Russia, and he grabbed by the scruff of their necks Hitler and Stalin and brought them to the Court of Justice in New York. He was even with characters who were as vile as them. He basically believed in bringing them to justice, not in meting out justice himself.
Given the fact that Warner Brothers is coming out with an even newer Superman in 2013, it does cause me to ask. You talked earlier about how the Superman adjusts to every era. Do you know anything about how they're going to portray Superman in 2013 or what this film's going to look like that will have us believing still in 2013 he's an evolving character, a man of his times?
All I know about it is that I know that they are exceedingly sensitive to whether it's going to work in terms of they tried a film in 2006 called Superman Returns. They were hoping for another four-film sequence like with Christopher Reeve. It didn't work out, and they this time want to get two things right. They want to have the right character, and they've chosen a British character named Henry Cavill, who stars in a show called The Tudors, and they're very sensitive about what their script will look like and whether they'll get the story right. And the only thing we've seen of it was a 30-second trailer that played during DC Comics and Warner Brothers' recent Batman film, The Dark Knight Rises. And what they know is they will hear in this internet era instantaneously from fans if they screw up the mythos. And so they want to, on the one hand, give us a new and a contemporary story, and yet they want to get right the essential element of who Superman really was. And what gives me the greatest faith is the guy who did the Batman Dark Knight trilogy, Christopher Nolan, is also a central figure in producing this new Man of Steel movie. And they say it's going to be a bigger blockbuster than Batman or Spider-Man or The Avengers has been this summer.
Well, you've had such a remarkable career, especially in choosing the right kind of heroes to write your books about. I understand that your next endeavor is a biography of Robert F. Kennedy. I know there have been Kennedy biographies today. Could you share with us why you chose Kennedy and what you think you have to offer in a new biography of Robert F. Kennedy?
Well, I chose him partly for the same reasons I did Superman. He was a childhood hero of mine, and I'm fascinated by him. And I have what I think is the newest thesis that Random House bought the book from me. But whether I get it right or wrong, what I can say definitively is, given the age of Kennedy's family and friends, Robert Kennedy would be 85 today if he were alive, and they're all sadly dying off. And I've been able to talk to scores of them while they're still alive and while they are uninhibited because they're old enough, they don't care what they say. And I think that for better or worse, mine may be the last first-person kind of story ever told about him, and so I hope I can get it right, and I hope my thesis is interesting enough that you'll have me back on your show someday.
Oh, we sure will. And by the way, when it comes to these interviews, you did obviously the same thing with Superman. Were you able to get complete cooperation with all the families of the folks who are left?
I got extraordinary cooperation. If you try hard enough, if you're an old, obnoxious reporter like me, and you work at it hard enough, you generally end up with it. And you have, you know, a year and a half, 2 years to do a book, so that's plenty of time to give people a chance to say no three times, hoping the fourth time they'll say yes, and most of them did.
Well, Larry, this has been so much fun talking with you. A great book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Great to have you on the show again, and let's have you back when you finish up the Robert F. Kennedy book. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me on again.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Larry Tye. Next week, Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.